Welcome to the Manufacturing Executive Podcast, where we explore the strategies and experiences that are driving mid-sized manufacturers forward. Here, you'll discover new insights from passionate manufacturing leaders who have compelling stories to share about their successes and struggles. And you'll learn from B2B sales and marketing experts about how to apply actionable business development strategies inside your business. Let's get into the show.
Welcome to episode number 200 of the Manufacturing Executive Podcast. I'm Joe Sullivan, your host and a co-founder of the industrial marketing agency Gorilla 76, where we help B2B manufacturers grow through revenue-focused marketing programs. Just shy of 4 years ago, I made the decision to launch a podcast. And as a marketing guy co-leading an agency that works specifically with B2B manufacturers, my inclination was to make a show about, well, marketing for manufacturers. But before I pulled the trigger, I received some sage advice that set me on a different path for this show. Dan Sanchez, then of podcasting agency Sweetfish Media, called me up and said, "No, Joe, you're not going to do a show where you talk about marketing with manufacturing leaders, because manufacturing leaders are not experts in marketing. They are experts in running manufacturing organizations. So what you're going to do instead is create a podcast where you interview them and the people who are experts in the wide range of topics that they care about. And you are going to become one of the best facilitators or curators of meaningful content for those manufacturing leaders." And so the Manufacturing Executive Podcast was born. For 200 consecutive weeks, without missing a single Tuesday morning, I've published interviews with manufacturing leaders and professionals influencing manufacturing leaders about the things that matter most to them. We've had conversations about leadership, building great cultures, supply chain challenges, the growing labor gap and creative solutions to address it, embracing the next generation, robotics and automation, digitization and Industry 4.0, AI and machine learning, and so much more. And man, am I a heck of a lot smarter for it. I've spent a considerable chunk of the last few weeks combing through past episodes, organizing my thoughts, and unearthing the most compelling sound bites I could from this collection of interviews that I've conducted. And so today's episode is a compilation of what I've heard and a summary of what I've learned. But before I dive in, I wanted to take a moment to say thank you to all of you who have been loyal fans and listeners of this show, as it's grown from relative obscurity to well over 1,000 weekly listeners. These first 200 episodes have been an incredibly rewarding body of work to have produced, and I have no intention of stopping anytime soon. So on that note, let's get into it. Part 1, Supply Chain. When episode number 1 of the Manufacturing Executive dropped in June of 2020, we were just a few months into the pandemic. The world was a mess, the economy was a mess, and here in the manufacturing sector, two big themes quickly came to dominate my interviews. One, supply chain, and two, labor. It's not as if these were new areas of pain and stress for manufacturing leaders, but the pain had certainly become much sharper. I'll begin with the first of these topics, and that is that supply chain disruption has changed the marketplace. Whether on this podcast or in conversations with manufacturing leaders in my own business operations, I've spoken with very few who haven't felt some level of pain in their respective supply chains, either during or in the aftermath of the pandemic. And protecting that supply chain has emerged as a more important topic than ever before. In episode 90, managing partner of Forsyth Advisors and supply chain expert Jim Pratt spoke about supply chain risk mitigation and what we can learn from the past as we look forward. Jim talked about how during times when the power shifts from buyer to seller, a different set of skills is required for effective sourcing. For example, proactively building your network to secure access to alternative sources and learning how to position your business as an important potential customer. In episode 129, CEO and co-founder of Datum, Rob Pakulski, shared insights about how to be more strategic in the procurement side of your manufacturing business. Here's what Rob had to say.
We spent a lot of our day looking at the parts we were actually sourcing. really reading through the blueprints, the CAD files, really understanding these parts, collaborating with engineers to see how those parts were manufactured. And then we were obsessed with knowing all of our suppliers and knowing what they're actually capable of doing based on their equipment, the processes they do. Sourcing at the end of the day is this multivariable matching process. You need to know both sides of the equation to be effective at that. And I think that us having this very technical sourcing lens to be able to really know what that part needs to be manufactured well, and then secondly, knowing who in our supply base does something well, really gave us a strong competitive edge and allowed us to source parts in 2 to 4 weeks for less cost than our competitors who were sourcing them in 6 to 8 months for significantly more cost. It really was that dramatic. So I think that I've been able to see the value of really empowering procurement, and it truly, truly is valuable.
In episode 50, I spoke with Harry Mosier, founder of the Reshoring Initiative. Our conversation revolved largely around his organization's mission to bring manufacturing back to the United States. Harry's economic case was strong for a variety of reasons, as were his arguments for creating more control over the supply chain. And while I'm on board with the mission behind Harry's Reshoring Initiative, there's one thing I've struggled to wrap my head around. If we can successfully reshore manufacturing jobs at scale in the years ahead, who's going to do all that work? And that leads me into the next major theme. Part 2, labor. Where are all the workers? This seemed to be the big mystery question everyone was trying to answer in 2021 and 2022 as the world adjusted to living through a pandemic, and into 2023 as the pandemic began to subside. But whether we're talking about your local restaurants or grocery stores, or we're talking about the shop floors of giant global manufacturing organizations, the inconsistency and uncertainty associated with labor availability seems to have changed permanently. And though my intent is not to fearmonger, it's a bit scary to think that on top of this, an average of 10,000 baby boomers are turning 65 years old every single day, or in other words, reaching retirement age. And as those boomers who have spent the last 40-some years working in the manufacturing sector walk out the door one by one, not only do they walk away with a wealth of tribal knowledge stored in their brains, but the challenges with filling gaps in labor will only deepen. What do we do? Where do we go? Will Healy III of Universal Robots will tell you to start by looking inside the walls of your own organization. He'll tell you it's not time to write off the boomers. It's time to embrace them. Here's what Will had to say in episode 120.
If we have this labor shortage, if someone still wants to work, how can we embrace that? Recently, the National Association of Manufacturers and the Manufacturing Institute did a poll of 3,000 people who left manufacturing. And they asked them, why did you leave? And 82% retired due to age or health, not because they were done working or because they didn't want to work anymore. They retired due to age or health. And so my call to action is these boomers have tons of knowledge in their brain. These are the most experienced people in your company. They know your company probably better than you do. So how can we keep those people in our organizations? Instead of expecting the boomers to provide the same level of physical output as a 22-year-old kid, let's take the value that they have and let's apply it in different ways, right? How can we use their brains instead of their bronze?
Not unlike Will, host of Mavens of Manufacturing, Megan Zimba, will tell you to look inside your existing workforce. An incredible advocate for women in manufacturing, Megan presented a slew of ideas in episode 71 for how today's manufacturing leaders can create a more flexible and accommodating workplace for women.
I'm very blessed to have my mom and 5 other siblings that can help when they have time to. But if none of them are available, I have to take off work or my husband has to take off work. So if there's a way to maybe compensate for some of that cost, I don't think anyone would have a problem taking a little hit on their salary. A lot of times people demand high salaries because it's helping them pay for something else, whether it's travel or living expenses or child daycare. Manufacturers that can find creative ways to have flex hours, I think, is important too. So if people want to work on Saturdays or Sundays so that they can take one day out of the week off, why not? As long as they're creating the product and getting it done. I think if manufacturers can provide some creative ways, a lot more women would be interested in entering the sector.
While Megan and Will shared ideas for how to look inside your existing workforce to build better cultures and retain the amazing people you already have, I've also had the privilege of hearing from a wide range of manufacturing leaders and advocates about how to look outside your walls. One of the most inspiring interviews I've conducted was in episode 58 with Drew Crow and Justin Sherman. Drew, founder of the New American Manufacturing Renaissance, is a super passionate advocate for the next generation of the manufacturing workforce. But as an African American who looks around and sees very few people who look like him in American manufacturing facilities, Drew is also an incredible advocate for diversity in this sector. In our conversation, Drew spoke about the opportunity to go into our big American cities and expose manufacturing to segments of our population who otherwise would not have realized it was even an option for them.
If you look at St. Louis, you know, we're both very familiar with it. And St. Louis is a city that looks like a lot of the major cities. It kind of mirrors in Chicago or Detroit, where a lot of the manufacturing has left the city proper. And we see the effects of the jobs that leave, the tax money that leaves, and the opportunity that leaves along with it, right? So our cities and our inner cities are dying and they're getting a little bit rougher because it seems like there's a lot of scarcity. And manufacturing is one of the things that can solve those scarcity issues and those jobs issues, because most of our entry-level jobs pay very high. So we definitely have to bring it back and include the areas that most of the population is going to need it.
While African Americans represent a massive segment of our workforce that's underrepresented in manufacturing, there are many other subsets of our population who are available and ready to work. In episode 135, titled Navigating Entrepreneurship and the Stigma of Autism, I interviewed Peter Mann, CEO and founder of the air purification system manufacturer, Oransi. Peter was diagnosed with autism as an adult, a diagnosis that helped him make sense of many challenges he experienced throughout his life and into his entrepreneurial journey. But as an incredibly successful business owner, he's not only an advocate for those living with autism, but an educator of business leaders for how to bring them into your workforce. In episode 96, titled Changing Lives While Growing Profits by Hiring Disabled Workers, VP of Manufacturing and Logistics at Pride Industries, Tony Lopez, shared how his organization is creating jobs for the disabled population in the manufacturing sector. In episode 191, titled Cultivating Veteran Champions in Manufacturing, retired Lieutenant Colonel Kathy Lowry Galowitz very passionately shared her perspective on why veterans are such ideal fits for manufacturing jobs. She also explained in detail the difference between being veteran-friendly and being truly veteran-ready. And meanwhile, 100 miles east of Lexington, Kentucky, a woman named Kathy Walker is transforming a dying coal mining workforce into an advanced manufacturing workforce. Here's what Kathy, founder and CEO of eCAMI, the eKentucky Advanced Manufacturing Institute, had to say.
We are upskilling the region's workforce for new careers in the advanced manufacturing industry, more specifically, CNC machining and robotics. We are teaching in-demand skills and in preparation for jobs of today's economy. This initiative was started to address the need for job creation and economic diversification in this area following years of declining employment in the mining industry. So when that industry began to fade, not only the direct mining jobs, but all the support industries took a hit with it. So we have thousands of incredibly talented and skilled people who were left without meaningful job opportunities. So we had to do something. And eCAMI started about 4 years ago. And its approach has been kind of untraditional. We are a Haas Center. We partnered with the Gene Haas Foundation. So this is a Haas Technical Education Center. And we have developed up-to-date curriculum. And our people are being sought after by employers all across the country. And they're doing everything from CNC machining to installing robots, customer support. And we're very proud of the success that they have had thus far.
These ideas represent just a sampling of the forward-thinking solutions I've heard about finding and retaining labor. However, any conversation about labor in manufacturing would be far from complete if we didn't look toward the future of the manufacturing sector. What about 10 years from now? 5 years from now? Heck, even 1 year from now? What about the next generation that will choose to either enter or not enter the manufacturing workforce? Part 3, the next generation. In the minds of so many Gen Zers and their parents, the word manufacturing drums up imagery of dark, dingy factories, unsafe work environments, and grueling, mindless, repetitive labor on production lines. But for those of you listening who spend your days inside of modern manufacturing facilities, you get to see what the general public does not. You see robots. You see exciting advanced technology. You see opportunity. Those of you who are nodding your heads right now are the ones we need to step up and show today's youth and also their parents what they don't get to see every day. Terry Iverson is the founder of a nonprofit organization called Champion Now. And Champion is an acronym that stands for Change How American Manufacturing's Perceived in Our Nation. Here's what Terry's doing to make a difference with today's youth.
Probably the most exciting latest news is we just launched a camp called Camp Champ, which is a camp that we run twice a day for multiple days around the state of Illinois and ultimately around the country, where we introduce young people, middle schoolers, with the help of high schoolers, mentoring the middle schoolers into manufacturing a pen with laser engraving so that their name is on the case of the pen. And they go through a process of assembling the pen and manufacturing the pen during the camp. And so when you have the middle schoolers that are being mentored by the high schoolers, then they get to high school, then they become the mentors and they're mentoring middle schoolers going forward. And hopefully it draws into the Project Lead the Way or CTE programs long term.
Meanwhile, at Elva Strum High School in Northwest Wisconsin, reading, writing, and arithmetic are complemented by machining, welding, and fabrication. In episode 49, Matt Goosey introduces Cardinal Manufacturing, a student-run machine shop, where these high school students not only learn the trades alongside the more conventional elements of a high school curriculum, but are also paid for the work they do right there in school. In episode 60, COO of Skills USA, Dr. Jason Scales, introduces a super intriguing idea to celebrate the trades as an exciting and meaningful career path. Here's what Dr. Scales had to say.
We celebrate the top athletes that are going on to professional athletics, and they're going to be in the NBA or the NFL. And so all these youth, what they start doing is they start forming these ideas. I'm going to be that NBA player. I'm going to be that NFL player. And they set their sights on that goal, right? Why can't we do the same with skilled trades? Why can't we bring industry together? Why can't we bring these students together and say, we're going to have a skills draft? And here we got all these students. They're going to apply and they're going to interview. They're the best of the best, right? And how awesome would it be that now we're announcing out there the skills draft, and here's company A. And they're going to pay $30,000 to get the number one draft pick for the welder. They value this person so much, they're going to pay $30,000 for the number one draft pick. All monies go back to the program from which the student comes. And that's how we're going to get people excited about skill. That's how we're going to get people excited about skilled trades. Wouldn't you like to be the family member or the mom and dad that your son or daughter just got picked for the number one draft? I don't care if it's a computer-aided drafting, nursing, occupational therapy, welding, building trades, what it is. But if we really want to excite the public and really bring some momentum to what we can do with getting skilled trades going, we've got to make it exciting. We've got to make it relevant. And we've got to get people to understand that these are true jobs that are very well-paying jobs. They're high wage, high skill. And let's reward these people for being the top.
And who better to hear from in this conversation about the manufacturing workforce of the future than a passionate Gen Zer who's been living it since he was 15 years old? Here's a soundbite from episode 195 with Jacob Sanchez, which was titled "The Real Reason Manufacturers Are Missing with Gen Z."
So I'm a FIRST Robotics judge. I've been judging FIRST Robotics for the past 6 years. Worldwide competition from first graders all the way up until 12th graders that build robots, Lego robots, a little bit bigger robots, and then big robots in high school. And I go to these competitions. There are hundreds and thousands of students in this organization around the world, and then thousands and thousands at the competitions I go to, California, Texas, Michigan. And they're excited. They feel fulfilled. Each of these teams is a mini business, Joe. I'm telling you, they have a salesperson that talks to like the judges. They have a marketing team. They have a budgetary team, depending on the size and stuff. This is the structure. And then they have a build team, a drive team, and a programming team. That's a business. And when these kids are going out into other businesses to get funding, that's partnership. That's relationship building. And so I'm watching all this happen, and it didn't hit me until maybe a year ago, where I'm looking at all of this and I'm like, where are the Fanex? Where are the KUKAs? Where are the Schunks? Where are all these companies? Even not the big name brands. Where are these integrators? Where are these OEMs? Where are my friends? Like, at these competitions to talk with these kids about a path that they can follow and go down. And that's when it hit me, man, is we're complaining about this skills gap and we're still thinking about it like 10, 15 years ago when it was a visibility issue, which it still somewhat is. But when I'm looking at organizations like this, it's not a visibility issue. It's a fact that we're not going out there as business owners, as leaders in our organization from an HR standpoint, business development, to recruit these kids. We need to be going to these kids that are already ridiculously passionate, and maybe they feel like they have to go to college because it's their only choice. Show them that they can come work for us.
We've talked a lot already about how to take on the growing labor gap through smart, creative ways to reach human beings. But we also have the robot. Part 4, automation. In episode 86, CEO of Mission Design and Automation, Scott Lindemann, defines what he calls the new ROI of automation. Whereas manufacturing leaders may have once looked at automation exclusively through the lens of machines replacing humans for efficiency purposes, cue up Arnold Schwarzenegger as the Terminator, the new ROI of automation is about the opportunity cost of not automating.
We used to use $45,000 to $50,000 a person as the cost of a person. They said literally they're up to $95,000 a year right now as their cost. And they factored in a different ROI numbers because they're considering that they have lost opportunity costs in there when they don't get people. And those people don't come in every day, but they've got to be tolerant of them. They have sicknesses. They have outages right now. So they factored more things in. That's not the pure value of the person, but it's the amount of money that it takes the company to replace that person if they're not there. And that's how much money they've allocated now. So it's definitely a trend where it's harder to find the people. It's definitely a trend where the cost to have people and have them be an integral part of your process depends on people in different ways. And there's a cost associated with getting those people or having the wrong person or not having a person at all. How quickly you can change your mindset and make your manufacturing processes less reliant on people is right now the main topic of discussion, right? It's about reevaluating your internal processes and how can we make our processes less dependent on having the one person who knows how to do this job be critical to our company.
One theme that has emerged through a range of conversations I've conducted with manufacturing automation leaders is the perception that automation is just too big of a leap to take. It's all or nothing. It's too intimidating. And because our business is complex, it simply won't work for us. In episode 64, founder and CEO of Plus One Robotics, Eric Nieves, reminded us, and very passionately so, that automating doesn't, in fact, have to be all or nothing.
Hear me, people. Make it your strategy to have automation and people complement one another. Send to the robot what it can do. And hopefully that's greater than 50 or 60 or 70%. But then be okay with having a manual station. That's one approach. The other is, okay, we're going to use a robot. We're going to have automation, but we're going to include a human in the loop to deal with the exceptions.
In episode 113, VP of Marketing at Dexterity, Michael Perry, dove into some of the highly advanced functions today's robots can perform as they become more and more intelligent. A complex manufacturing environment should no longer lead to the assumption that we can't automate. Here's what Michael had to say.
With one robot, we were able to pick at the unit level all of this wide mix, I think, of over 10,000 SKUs. And each one of those SKUs is slightly different because bread, as it bakes, it puffs differently and shrink wrap around it morphs in different funny ways. The tortillas flop in a way that a cookie box doesn't. So one robot had to be able to pick each one of those goods and pick at the tray level and fit within this existing workflow, which is like a street of all of these different single SKU goods and all of these orders that are going back the other side. So that really required a wide variety of cutting edge robotic approaches.
Once you figure out where and how to automate inside your manufacturing facility, what about the cost? In episode 51, CEO of Path Robotics, Andy Lonsberry, introduced a different business model for deploying robots for a specific niche application that makes them more accessible and less risky from a financial investment perspective.
You sign up to a subscription for our robotic system. We deliver the system. We tell you the quality metric. We tell you the KPIs around cycle time that you're going to see on your parts. And that system has to perform every single day or you don't pay. And so what we're trying to do is enable these manufacturers to be able to move into automation immediately. There is no large CapEx spend up front. They don't have to go try to get the cash to make that happen. They are looking at something that's very comparable to their labor prices and their labor costs that they can put onto their OpEx spend and immediately be utilizing robots to continue to expand their manufacturing operations on day one and not 3 years down the line.
My conversations with manufacturing automation leaders merely scratched the surface of what's possible in this arena. And robots are only a component of the advanced technology that's finding its way into manufacturing at a faster pace than ever before. All of this leads us to part 5, digitization and industry 4.0. In any part of our society, so many technological innovations are largely reserved in their earliest days for those with capital and infrastructure to pave the way. These innovators invest in R&D, they build hardware or software, they test it, they deploy it, and they refine it. And eventually, as those technologies are adopted by more companies, costs come down and they become more accessible to the masses. But right now, we're living in a period of deeper, more wide-reaching technological innovation than the manufacturing sector has ever seen. Words and phrases like digitization, industrial Internet of Things, the connected factory, Industry 4.0, AI, and machine learning have all found their ways into our regular vocabulary. And the accessibility of this technology from enterprise organizations all the way down to small machine shops has created a phenomenon that president of Siemens Industry Inc., Raj Batra, refers to as the great equalizer.
When I say the great equalizer, to me, it really speaks the scalability of every company being able to use it. So I always say the big winners in this are the small and mid-sized enterprises that, in essence, don't have a tremendous amount of capital, but you know, we'll take that same 2 billion euros of money that we spend on research and development, and they can use the same technology. They just get a scaled-down version. Or maybe they use an automation system that doesn't need to do all the same things that a bigger automation system does. But in essence, all the software is the same. All the innovation is the same. And of course, when you're in the SaaS models and you're using what you need and paying for what you need, they're getting access to the same technology. I mean, I've seen car washes, quite frankly, that have been far more sophisticated using Industry 4.0, where the car wash has been simulated. They've used artificial intelligence. They've used machine learning. They use the digital twin, and they perfected how this car wash runs before they built it. And now they can clone them and build, you know, thousands of them. And some of those are far more sophisticated than sometimes getting into the large enterprises where, you know, you've got very, very strong bureaucracies between the IT organization and the manufacturing organizations, and there's legacy there, and you've got to sort of break down that divide culturally in companies, which isn't always easy. So sometimes a smaller company is more agile, they can operate more quickly. And now today, technology is available to them. That same technology that we would sell to any big Fortune 5 company, the small guy can use too and get the same benefits out of it. And I think that to me is the great equalizer for small and mid-sized enterprises that want to capitalize on this.
No podcast episode alone could summarize the breadth of technological innovations and solutions we're seeing in manufacturing today. But I'll share bits and pieces that have come to the surface through some of my interviews. One recurring technology-related theme has been collaboration through software. Compared even to 5 short years ago, we have teams that are more spread out across the country or the globe, decentralized product data, supply chain challenges, and more demanding customers. And all of that points to a need for better communication and collaboration inside of manufacturing organizations. In episode 193, CEO of CoLab, Adam Keating, spoke to this need, specifically through the lens of engineering design reviews.
How do we make it so simple that anybody that's involved in that process can get feedback early and often and in parallel? How could you take the engineering team with the cross-functional groups and work right together? How could you bring in the suppliers and customers early in that process for their inputs without giving away all the keys to the castle? They don't need all the information. It doesn't need to be a huge effort, but how do you bring them in? And that's what CoLab really offers. We make it easy for you to pull those people in, parallelize that process, get their feedback and make decisions. And I think being able to do that then in a way where it's easy and people like to do it and people are hooked on doing it is really where we've kind of settled ourselves into building what we call a design engagement system.
In episode 34, CEO of Raven.ai and co-founder of Industry 4.0 Club, Martin Cloak, talked about pairing data from machines with human reasoning to make more informed decisions.
In manufacturing today, there are tons of companies out there providing analytics, maintenance software. Now, many of these systems rely on the data that's fed into them. And this data has been collected from machines for decades. But the most valuable data is to understand when the process is not running. When the process is not running, the way to get it is typically through manually entered methods. Either somebody writes it down, types it in Excel, or pulls a drop-down menu. So all of these systems sit on this rickety structure where humans are entering data into the system. And the fact that they're all sitting on top of this means that data quality is one of the biggest issues that people haven't emphasized. So half of the problem with many of these systems is data quality. And the fact that these other systems with analytics and dashboards are sitting on top of this poor data quality, people get burned. People get burned by getting pointed in the wrong direction. And what happens when you get burned a few times? You get disengaged. So you have these systems that exist to present metrics that people don't trust on the shop floor. And then at the core, people are going back to doing what they've been doing for 30 years, which is, you know, managing their day-to-day based on instincts. So to solve the Industry 4.0 challenge, you need to make sure that it's sitting on a foundation of good data. And then once people have confidence that the data is trustworthy, how do you give them a tool to allow them to take actions to identify and solve those problems more quickly?
In episode 123, co-founder of Overview.ai, Austin Appel, dove into the advancements in vision inspection technology, from camera quality to image recognition to machine learning. Today, we can reach into our pockets and pull out devices with better cameras than those running on the most advanced manufacturing production lines just a couple decades ago. The impact is that both from the standpoint of investment and technological feasibility, vision automation has become incredibly accessible to the masses. And while companies like Overview are advancing vision technology, another is pioneering the digitization of a different human sense, touch. In episode 173, CEO of Gelsight, Youssef Benmokhtar, introduces the technology behind the imaging-based tactile sensors his company has developed to imitate the function of human touch and feel for applications such as surface inspection. And then, of course, we have additive manufacturing. In episode 89, co-founder and CEO of Form Alloy, Melanie Lang, describes the digital warehouse that additive manufacturing enables. To quote Melanie, "With additive technology, you can simplify the entire supply chain by just having something there when you need it. And being able to even build it locally in many cases. And in episode 128, CEO of Post-Process Technologies, Jeff Mize, dives into applications for additive manufacturing that stretch well beyond the traditional low-volume prototyping limitations historically associated with 3D printing. Jeff describes how many of their customers are now measuring annual output of prototyped parts from their additive operations in tens of thousands, and some even in hundreds of thousands, and how he's watching a growing number of production applications emerging as well. I would, of course, be remiss to host a manufacturing podcast in 2024 that excludes perspectives from leaders in manufacturing AI technology. One of my very favorite interviews I've conducted was with Milan Kosic, founder and head of Sixth Sense. In episode 169, Milan spoke at length about how far AI will push engineering design, the essential role human beings will need to play alongside AI technology, and what manufacturing may look like a decade from now in light of rapidly evolving AI technology.
I am not a believer that you're going to walk up to a computer and say, design me a plane. I don't think that's a realistic future to think about. I'm sure AI could be able to do that, but it's going to be a weird looking plane, most likely. And whether it's actually going to fly would be a second question. But I think walking up to a computer and say, you know, design me a holder plate for the winglet of the right side with this kind of performance, and then AI goes out and gives you 30 options, it's probably a realistic scenario. And then you as an engineer come back and you pick one. But that means that instead of you spending 3 days to design something, you just spend 20 minutes designing something. The fantasy that I see is ultimately headless factories. And what I mean by that, you walk through, you have some nice glasses, but they look like this. They don't look like, you know, big helmets on your head. And you look at this device and you say, tell me what's the optimal operation of this, tells you what's happening, you're over here. So suddenly you have a factory in your head, in a sense, which means that information is just interconnected at all levels. And AI helps draw conclusion out of that information to run all the operations more efficiently and in time, ultimately.
In this past segment, we've explored technological innovation. In the next, we'll explore technological innovation intentionally designed with the best interest of our planet and the future generations that will inhabit it in mind. Part 6, sustainability. Every so often, one of my guests will speak words that send chills down my spine. And one of those moments occurred in episode 150 when CEO of Green Dot Bioplastics, Mark Remmert, described what's at risk for humanity as we look ahead.
For the last couple hundred years with Industrial Revolution, we have just had a relentless attack on the planet and on the environment. Populations have soared. We have extracted anything we wanted to use as a resource, and we threw it away without much regard to what happened afterwards. But in the middle of last century, I think as humans, we began to see how unsustainable that was. And maybe at first we wanted to bury our heads in the sand. But as early as World War II, we saw the effects of radiation and really, really toxic kinds of pollution. We learned that toxins don't go away. I've seen the old posters. It's hard to imagine, but at one point in time, the EPA had a slogan that said, dilution is the solution to pollution. And therefore, if you want to get rid of something, just dilute it before you dump it in the river or the lakes or whatever. And then it began to affect humans. We saw places like Times Beach in Missouri, dioxin pollution and whole populations uprooted, and their community turned into a Superfund site. And similar with Hooker Chemical in New York and solvents. We began to hear about human cancer clusters and so forth. And so we were getting the feedback then, but for whatever reason, you know, it's taken until the last 20 years, I think, for sustainability to really penetrate our hearts and our minds and our politics and our actions. And still not everybody is on board, but I believe this sustainability thing is really driven by a human instinct that if we don't change our course, humans are not going to be here forever.
While Mark's words may be powerful enough to stop any manufacturing leader in his or her tracks, We all know what happens when an owner, CEO, or president is forced to make a decision between sustainability and profitability. And when that's the case, how can our planet ever win? Well, in episode 138, CEO of Okabashi Brands, Sarah Irvani, explained how her organization, a closed-loop manufacturing and recyclable bio-based footwear manufacturer, is on a mission to prove that sustainable American manufacturing can indeed flourish at scale. In our conversation, Sarah leaned specifically into lean manufacturing principles that optimized waste reduction. And in episode 122, CEO and co-founder of GuideWheel, Lauren Dunford, addressed the same set of conflicting priorities that manufacturing leaders are forced to grapple with. Our conversation focused on the business case for why manufacturing leaders should care about sustainability.
What we've seen in the past year or so is that sustainability has become a real and concrete driver of business value in a very different way than it was previously. So that's really where GuideWheel and I, you know, tend to watch it is when is this going to matter and move the needle meaningfully on business value relative to other levers that our manufacturing leaders have. And the three reasons we're seeing there are, first of all, from a customer-facing side, whether it's B2B or B2C, there's an ability for environmental sustainability to open up access to new markets and channels and really be a competitive differentiator with customers that's changing in a very real way. The second area is with investors, just increasing real effort to not only talk about, but also quantify on that sustainability side and the investing landscape. And then the third being that regulatory area.
The topic of additive manufacturing emerged once again in episode 184 with CEO and co-founder of Hylos, Elias Stahl. Our episode was titled Building an On-Demand Supply Chain in America's Urban Core. And in the conversation, Elias unpacked the mindset and methodology behind how his footwear manufacturing business is simplifying production while reducing waste.
Footwear for us is a ground zero focus for inefficiency and waste. It's a barely industrialized supply chain. Most of the technology dates from the Civil War. So you have the upfront production cost that you would with any tooling category, but you also have 2 to 4 hours of labor into every pair, depending on the product category. So very inefficient, high degree of overproduction as a result. We make 24 billion shoes. 1 out of 5 goes straight to the landfill every year. And so there's not only a striking need on the environmental side, but also on the consumer and business side to find ways to do things more efficiently. And that's where Hylos began its focus. Hylos fundamentally creates new methods to make for footwear that allows us to take what was once 160 parts assembled in 350 steps and reduces that to 5 parts assembled in 12 steps with a fraction of the labor and without any tooling costs. We do this by developing not only new methods of make, but also leveraging additive manufacturing and generative design to simplify the production process, to adopt zero waste manufacturing technologies.
In a very prescient interview with President of Phoenix Contact, Jack Nalig, we took a glimpse into a more sustainable manufacturing future as he described some powerful forces driving us toward what he describes as an all-electric society. Jack also shares how his company is walking the walk with a manufacturing facility that generates all of its own electricity. We've talked a lot here about technology and how the manufacturing leaders of the future will need to embrace change. But from an innovation standpoint, what's essential and what's not? Where do we make investments? How far ahead of the technology adoption curve do we need to be? And how do we innovate without overwhelming our respective teams? These are just some of the questions the manufacturing leaders of the future will have to answer. And that leads us to the final segment of this episode. Part 7, Leadership. In episode 166, Industry 4.0 and digital transformation influencer Jeff Winter shares a wealth of insight into the topic of innovation and the role manufacturing leaders need to play in that arena. Specifically, Jeff explains why manufacturing leaders need to formalize the effort to innovate inside of their respective organizations. Here's a soundbite from our discussion.
We have to create an environment where employees are encouraged to think creatively, to take risks, and to challenge the status quo. This could be fostering kind of open communication, promoting collaboration, recognizing and rewarding innovative ideas, and accepting failure as part of the learning process. Unfortunately, that last one is by far the hardest step. And so it requires a huge endorsement by the leadership and having management at all layers integrating this into everyday workflows. And probably the last one I'd say is provide resources and tools. Allocate, this is everything from time, money, and personnel to support innovation. This may include creating innovation labs or spaces that people can do it. I mean, there's even some companies that dedicate a portion of everyone's time on innovative ideas and projects. You can invest in research and development, or you can provide training and tools to help employees think creatively and develop new ideas.
And while there's no denying the need to embrace innovation, certain fundamental characteristics of great leaders remain evergreen. My conversation with COO of Fabrisonic, Jason Riley, centered around what he called the five key principles for creating a culture of initiative. Those five things are: 1, leading by intent; 2, doing by delegating; 3, empowering decision-making; 4, maximizing collaboration; and 5, processes are performance. All five of these principles really hit home for me in what instantly became one of my personal favorite episodes. But this particular quote really stuck out to me.
How many times do employees ask, why am I doing this? Or how many times in an organization does a manager say, I don't know, boss just wants it done, right? But that hinders the ability for team members and employees to make good decisions. Then it just becomes getting the task done, right, vice the larger purpose behind that task. We might be making a part and the feeds and speeds just don't cut it, or a machine can't achieve the feeds and speeds necessary, or a particular geometry is not possible, or you can name 100 different situations where an employee comes across a challenge and they have to decide what to do next. If they know that larger purpose, they can make a decision to achieve the company's larger end state for that product. But if they don't have that larger purpose, what are they going to do? They're going to turn around and ask the manager, what do you want me to do? And that's going to slow collective decision-making down, and that's going to slow success down for a company. That's what I mean about leading by intent. And in fact, I would argue that in most cases, in many cases, when a task isn't accomplished effectively, when a leader's expectations aren't met, it's because there wasn't a larger purpose given. And so the team member or employee didn't really understand why they were doing something. And I would also say that the number one job of any leader, from CEO on down, is to provide clear guidance. You have to provide that overarching intent.
Well, we have covered a lot here in episode 200. The reality is that I could never truly encompass everything I've learned across 200 conversations as the host of this show in a single episode summary. But these were some of the highlights. If I had to sum up my own feelings, I would tell you that the future of manufacturing looks bright. And though things are changing quickly and there's a lot of work to be done, it's the people like you who are keeping your eyes and ears as well as your minds open who will lead the way. Once again, thank you for your listenership, and I hope to catch you on the next episode of The Manufacturing Executive.
You've been listening to The Manufacturing Executive Podcast. To ensure that you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast player. If you'd like to learn more about industrial marketing and sales strategy, you'll find an ever-expanding collection of articles, videos, guides, and tools specifically for B2B manufacturers at gorilla76.com/learn. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.